I'd like to welcome everyone to Spotlight. Delighted you could join us today on this really great day for ForThePeople.com, the premiere of our stereo streaming audio this morning with Mar. Wasn't that fantastic? That was just so exciting. I tell you, there's lots of big and new things going on around here, and I'll just say stay tuned for more. Believe me, there is more to come. And right now, there's Spotlight to come. Spotlight, of course, is a program on For the People in which we interview a member of For the People, learn a little bit more about their life and life experiences. And I'd like to, before we get started with the interview, thank Dennis, of course, faithful Dennis, for always recording and editing our programs for us for the purpose of archiving. We'll ask that you hold your questions and comments for our guest until the completion of the interview. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Steve Pallett to introduce his guest for today. Steve?
Well, thank you very much, Becky. And once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to host Spotlight for you. And today, the guest in the hot seat is Doug Armstrong. And can I thank you for agreeing to be interviewed, Doug? I hope it's not going to be too much of an ordeal for you. And I'm sure you've got a very, very interesting story to tell us. Can I begin by asking you to tell us where and when you were born?
Well, thanks for having me, Steve. It's my pleasure. I was born in Dallas, Texas, but raised in Arkansas. Actually, my mother just happened to be in Dallas going to nursing school, and I put a halt to those plans, and she was from Arkansas, so she moved back home when I was 3 months old. So I was really raised in Arkansas, but I claim Dallas because that's where I was born.
And have you always had problems with your eyesight from a baby?
Yes, I have, Steve. In fact, as close as I can get, the most specific term we can break my visual problem down to is a recessive dystrophy, a recessive pigmentary dystrophy. Some people can really put a specific name to their condition, but I can't. It's kind of rare. But I was born blind and raised in a little town called McGee, Arkansas, 5,200 people. So, you know, there weren't too many people familiar with how to deal with blindness there.
Would you mind sharing with us something about your immediate family? Mum and Dad, what about them? What would you say?
Well, I have a really interesting family life. I'm the oldest of five in terms of my mom's side. When I was born, my mother and my real dad never married. And then my mom was dating a guy who went over to Vietnam, and my brother was born, and he never came back from Vietnam, died in Vietnam. And then she married my current stepdad, and there were three children, two sisters and a baby brother who was born when I was 19 years old and in college. So they always say he was a welcomed accident. I do have a relationship with my real dad who lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and I have two sisters. I'm really the oldest of seven. My parents sent me to a residential state-supported school for the blind in Little Rock, Arkansas when I was 5 years old. And I would go home, like a lot of people who attended blind schools, every other weekend at first. And then after a while, once I got involved in lots of activities, I wouldn't go home that often. The household, as I said, it was interesting. When I was little, because I was living with my stepdad, the environment wasn't ideal for me. It's gotten better in later years, but my parents made some mistakes, particularly my stepdad, because for the longest it was four of us, of course, two girls and two boys, and me and my brother, we got left at home a lot, and the girls would go out shopping a lot, and there was a lot of favoritism, but in the later years, my stepdad did atone for those things. So I've put that behind me, but as I said, life was a little interesting growing up. Got a lot of disciplinary action for things that I didn't do. I'm sure we've all been there or got blamed for something we didn't do at some point in our life, though.
So, from what you're saying, I gather that you were left to fend for yourself in the early years. Did you have an adventurous childhood? Were you forever going out, or were you prevented from going out by your stepdad because you thought you may injure yourself because you were blind, or were you left to your own devices?
Left to my own devices. They never prevented me from going out, especially once I started the school for the blind and I came home and they saw just how, quote, smart, unquote, I was, as that's the term they used, and how independent I was. I did some things that if they knew about, though, they would freak. My brother, who's 2.5 years younger than I am, and we're really, really close, he understood more than anybody just how much I could see. I was educated as a totally blind student, and I'm a Braille reader. However, I do have a little more than light perception. I can see images from really close up. We used to go bicycle riding. He and one of my cousins, when I was 10 years old, they taught me how to ride a bike. They would walk beside me and hold the handlebars, and after a while I was pedaling and they weren't holding on and I didn't realize it. And then when they told me they weren't holding on, then I stopped. But we had these bikes and I would get behind him and go all over the neighborhood. And we had these wooden bridge that there was this big ravine, and when it rained it would fill up with water. And there was this wooden plank bridge over the ravine that was wide enough maybe for two people to walk across side by side, if that big. And we would ride across this thing on our bicycles. I would be right behind my brother, and we'd cross the track a couple of times. The train would stop on the tracks, and we'd be somewhere we had no business being, and my mother would get off work at 3:30, so we're supposed to be home. If the train was on the track and wasn't moving, guess what? We'd have to go underneath the train. So I did some things that not only were adventuresome, but when I look back, were just downright foolish.
Incredible. Oh boy, thank goodness the train didn't move, otherwise we wouldn't be talking, I don't think. Okay, so you had a pretty adventurous childhood through circumstance. So when you got to school for the blind at 5 years old, what were your impressions? Do you remember actually being taken to the residential school for the blind? And if so, what can you share with us of your early memories?
Yeah, a lot of people, they have memories of crying. I just really wasn't sure. I don't know if my parents really sat me down and explained to me where I was going, and if they had, I don't know if I would have understood. I just know we got in a car one day, and we rode for a long time, and I was happy because I'd never gotten to go that far of a distance with them, and they were dropping me off. And it's interesting. I remember the very first person I met, the very first kid I met at the School for the Blind, was this kid named Donnie Brown at the water fountain, and he showed me how the water fountain worked and how to get a drink of water. So he was there before I was. He's known as Robert. I guess he's on the... I ran into him one day several years later, a couple of months ago on the site. But anyway, I was in, I guess, dorm one was the dorm for kindergarten kids. There were 9 of us in that dorm, and we had a wonderful house mother. Her name is Ms. Decker. I never knew what her first name was because we were taught to address the adults by Mr. and Mrs. So it was Ms. Decker in dorm one and Ms. Lawrence in dorm two and so on and so forth. Once I got in high school, I kind of learned people's names. But it was that's where I came out. I grew up under a totally different value system than my siblings did, and obviously was exposed to a lot more than I would have been exposed to had I grown up in the little town of McGee, Arkansas.
So you were allowed to return home periodically for weekends, as you know, apart from the holidays. Obviously, you would go home at Easter and Christmas and summer vacations and things like that. But you were allowed to go home. Did it seem strange going back home or not? What I'm trying to get at is, were you happier at school or were you happier at home?
At first, I don't think it mattered when I remember getting on the Trailways was the big thing in those days in the 70s. Getting on the Trailways bus the first time home and just reciting some things I'd learned in kindergarten and my family being so impressed with me. So for a while, it was fun going home. But then by the time I was in third grade, it really wasn't, because my parents would drop me off at my grandmother's house and I would stay there the whole weekend, and I really wanted to be at home, because at home I had my talking book machine and I could go back and read, and I didn't have access to that at my grandmother's house. And there were just a lot of things. Me and my brother would be dropped off at my grandmother's house and my sisters would be home. So after a while, I guess there's some things that my parents didn't understand. For example, when company was around, you know, you're visually impaired. I did a lot of exploring, so I would explore things with my hands, and I would get my hands slapped a lot and stop that, or stop looking that way, or go to your room whenever someone came over. It appeared as if my parents were embarrassed for me to be around, even though I'd just be sitting there looking at TV, watching a cartoon, or later on a football game, and I would always have to go to the back. So after a while, I felt more comfortable at the School for the Blind. And in fact, I got in a lot of extracurricular activities. I don't think it was conscious. I think on a subconscious level, it was so I wouldn't have to go home. In third grade, I joined the wrestling team, track team. Fourth grade, I joined band. I was in choir. I was in so many extracurricular activities. And in high school, I probably went home, maybe for the break. After a while, it was just when the school shut down for Christmas, Easter, and all, and maybe two or three times in addition to that.
When you were actually at school and you'd gone past your first period there, what were your favourite subjects? I suppose, you know, when you were a small child, I suppose you learnt Braille and things like that. But as you got older and your understanding of things developed, what were your favourite subjects?
And before I get there, I have to tell this story. My favourite subject, period, was mathematics. That's always been my favourite subject. But I liked history. I liked spelling, although I'm not the greatest speller now. I didn't care too much for English, probably because that was my weakness. I loved music class. I loved singing those songs in the early years. That's what's missing now. But when I was in the first grade, a lot of people don't know this. I flunked the first grade. I had this teacher, named Miss Muntz, who taught the first and second grade at the same time. And she had the Braille students and print students. She really wasn't good with Braille students. And I was so afraid of her. She was an elderly black lady, and of course I'm African American, and for most things that's irrelevant, but for this story it's relevant, because Miss Muntz she grew up in that era where it was really hard. Of course, she came up in that civil rights era. So she wanted the black students to excel. So she was much harder on them. And that ended up backfiring, because I was so afraid of her. Whether I was right or wrong, I wouldn't speak up. She intimidated the mess out of me. She really did. And to the point that I couldn't learn. And you know how kids are. You tell them they're dumb and they start to believe they're dumb. Well, I was beginning to believe that I was dumb. The next year, I was put in the first grade again, and I had another teacher. At the time, her name was Miss Lazarus, and she was great. She knew when to compliment me and when to tell me when I did wrong, and I excelled. I was the top student in that class. And that year, I took both the first grade and the second grade achievement tests and excelled in both. And so I skipped the second grade, so I ended up not being a year behind, because I failed the first grade, but I skipped the second grade. So, but, you know, in retrospect, it just makes me think about what a fine line there is between, I guess, what was termed as vocational versus academic student. When I was coming up in high school, you could go the vocational track or the academic track or even maybe remedial. And I know that there have been some kids who are lost in the shuffle all because of a slow start. And I sort of hold my breath sometimes and think, phew, man, what it could have been.
Yes, indeed. And as we'll discover later, you excelled in quite a few areas, Doug. You mentioned a few minutes back that you were really keen on athletics and that you said you did wrestling and so on. I can understand that because you've got physical contact with your opponent. But could you just explain to me the process of a blind person running on the track? How is that achieved without you crashing into each other and, well, falling over, to be quite honest? How did you manage to do that? What's the technique?
Sure. And wrestling was, I actually ultimately ended up winning 5 state championships and 3 national championships under competition under the United States Association for Blind Athletes. There are 2 techniques for running track. One, up through whenever we have wrestling meets against other blind schools, and I actually ran in some competition, state competition with sighted kids, but I use sighted guide, you know, the technique where you hold on to someone's elbow. So we'd have someone on the track team who was sighted, and I would hold on to their arm, and we would match our strides, and they would guide me. After a while, when I began running on a national level, and we'd go to national competition every year, there were guide runners for us, and in training for the Olympics for the blind, I participated in New York in 84 and set 3 U.S. records in track, the 800, 1500, and the 5K. The 1500 meter was my favorite race. Sighted guide technique was discouraged because the blind runner is supposed to set the pace, especially in the Olympics. So we used a tether, a rope or a shoestring, maybe 20 centimeters long. I would hold one end, and the guide runner would hold the other end. And the guide runner runs behind or beside you, but not in front of you. If the guide runner gets in front, you're going to be disqualified because, again, the blind participant is supposed to set the pace. And normally, depending on where the events were held, they would recruit college or high school sighted students to act as guide runners. Before we went to the Olympics, we trained for a week in St. Louis, and so USABA, again, the United States Association for Blind Athletes, they provided the guide runners. So I had this one guide runner I trained with for a week, and he would just tell me, okay, you're a step and a half to the ahead, you can cut to the inside now. And after a while, we got where we didn't have to talk, because I didn't like to exert energy. He could tighten the tether just so I would know just how far to turn or go around the curve. And that's hopefully I answered your question.
You most certainly did, Doug. Thanks for that explanation. I understand a little bit more now than I did a few minutes back. We've got a lot to get through in your life, Doug, but just briefly tell us about your interest in playing the saxophone. I know you're a very keen saxophone player. How did that all begin?
Well, in the 4th grade, I joined band just because I thought it was a cool thing to do. And a couple of my friends played the trumpet, so I wanted to play the trumpet. I didn't have the lip strength at the time. Today, that wouldn't be a problem, but at that time, I didn't. So I was put on the trombone because it had a bigger mouthpiece and it didn't require as much lip strength. But my arms were too short at the time. I couldn't slide the trombone slide all the way, extended it completely. So band director said, let's put you on the saxophone. And I've loved it ever since. So with the exception of 1 year, really, the 7th grade, and that's because in industrial arts, I cut my finger on a circle table saw. My little finger, I had to have surgery and stitch the finger. I almost lost it. So I couldn't do any athletics or band that year. So that was the 1 year I really didn't do much extracurricular. But other than that, I played the saxophone from 4th grade, and I still play for weddings and different events. I was in a had a gig after law school for a while. I played in a jazz band.
Do you read Braille music or do you play by ear?
Both. Even when you read Braille music, you end up playing by ear because in school, the band director taught me to read Braille music. But obviously, you can't sight read. You know, you can't use your fingers and read the music and play the instrument at the same time. So you learn a measure and you play it, and then you learn another measure and you play it, and before long, you end up memorizing it anyway. So, but in playing by ear, I can pick the saxophone up, and by listening, I can figure out the tune. In fact, now I've mostly played by ear, but gosh, I'd have to brush up on reading the music, but it would come back to me.
Fine. Now, as you came towards the end of your allotted time at school and as it came up to time for you to graduate, have you got any plans in your head as to what you wanted to do with your life?
I knew I wanted to go to college, and when I graduated from high school, of course, I was a math whiz. I'd entered in some statewide competition for math and actually attended, I took all the math courses that they offered at the School for the Blind. So for my senior year, I was transported to Central High, which was public school, for trigonometry. So I was going to go to college and get a double major in mathematics and political science because I was interested in politics. So I figured just in case I decided to go into politics, I wanted to get a degree in political science.
And how did you achieve that? Well, I suppose you achieved that, but what was the next step on the road to that?
Well, I had one of the people I really look up to, my wrestling coach back at the School for the Blind, a guy named Ray Stewart, who ended up being my counselor. He got me enrolled into Gardner-Webb College. It's Gardner-Webb University now. At the time, it was a little NAIA Southern Baptist school, because they had a program for the blind. Most schools have programs for the handicapped or disabled, whatever the, I'm not really sure what the term is now. It changes every year. But this school had an individual, its own program for the blind, and so me being the person who really loves attention, and the fact that they gave me a presidential scholarship, so they gave me money to go there, I chose that school. I've been going away from home all my life anyway, so the distance from Arkansas to North Carolina, which is about depending on how fast you go, anywhere from a 14 to 16-hour drive, you get on 40 and it's a straight shot. Didn't bother me. So, but I really ended up getting a double major in math and computer science and minoring in political science is the way it ended up happening. In getting the computer science degree, you had to have so many supportive hours of math, and I was only 4 math courses from another major, so I thought, what the heck, I'll just go ahead and get a math degree and computer science degree.
Well done, very, very good. I couldn't possibly tackle that. Maths and me do not mix. I have difficulty counting to 20 if I've got my shoes and socks on, Doug. So, well done. It's great. So, what about your social activities during this time? Was it all work, or were you able to have fun as well?
No, I really handled college about as well as I think anyone can handle it, because I was a good student. I graduated with honors, so I had a 3.6 or so, I can't remember that, 3.71, but I also did my share of fun and partying in college and hanging out. I was in lots of extracurricular activities. It was funny because there was an orientation program at Gardner-Webb the first week you're there, and you have a big brother and big sister, and you have all these activities. And after my freshman year, I wanted to be a big brother, so I was able to, provide the assistance that was provided for me. And after that first week, the class officers were elected, so I ran for freshman class president and won, and was really proud of that. And I was in student government, senate throughout college. I was in the band. It was small enough, it wasn't a marching band. That was difficult because they didn't have the music in Braille, And what the band director did is he made a tape of the music, and he played the saxophone parts for me, and I would sit in the room and learn the sax parts. Actually, the first year, the drum major worked with me, and she gave me the notes. And when she left, there was no one who could do that. So in addition to that, I got the tape, and so I would learn the music that way. I ran track in college. They were supposed to have a wrestling team when I started, but they didn't until my junior year, and by that time I'd lost interest. I actually got the most valuable cross-country runner award my junior year in college, and that made me extremely proud because at the School for the Blind in Arkansas, I was running mostly against other schools for the blind and blind students, and this was against sighted competition. So I was, that meant a whole lot. That's, like I said, I got to hang out a lot, made lots of friends. I even got in a little trouble. Gardner Webb is a, as I said, Southern Baptist affiliated school, and the dorms are not co-ed, and there's an alcohol policy. And I got caught with a little alcohol on campus, so I had to pay a $20 fine and get censored and all of this. And this professor held it against me, so he wouldn't let me in Alpha Chi, which was the honor society. And that really, the requirements were that you not be on disciplinary probation and that you have a 3.5 GPA, which I did. And he never allowed me. He just took my name off the list. And I fussed about it, and one of my advisors said, well, you know, some things you just got to let go. Just don't worry about it. But when I graduated, Gardner-Webb gives this award, one female and one male student, all-around student award, and I got that award at graduation. And one of the religion professors came up to me afterwards in the parking lot. My parents are standing around. He said, we showed that Dr. Morgan, didn't we? And Dr. Morgan is the person who kept me out of Alpha Chi. And I'm like, huh? And he goes, well, which would you rather have, to be in Alpha Chi or to be recognized as the male all-around student at Gardner-Webb, you know, for your 4 years? And so that, he said, you know, we all had your back. We got your best interest. So that was, in the grand scheme of things, Alpha Chi didn't matter.
There you go, Doug. That little drink didn't do you too much harm, did it? Very well done. Okay, so after you'd got your degrees from Gardner-Webb College, what next?
Well, I don't know. I had, like I said, an interesting life. Ultimately, I went to law school, and I didn't decide until my junior year in college I was going to go to law school. But I didn't go to law school right away because you have to take the LSAT, which is the law school admission test. And the organization that administers the exam, they misplaced my scores. Or what happened, they had my LSAT scores under the name of Douglas James Armstrong, which my name is James Douglas. And the last four digits of my Social Security number, the first digit was correct. They had my application of my transcript under James Douglas Armstrong and the wrong Social Security number. And I was calling every day or every week trying to figure out what was wrong. They said, we don't have your transcript yet. And finally, I told them, just go through all of the Armstrongs. They said, well, we have a Douglas James and a James Douglas. And I finally said, well, if you merge this name and this Social Security number, I'll be a whole person again. But I had my bags packed and a non-refundable plane ticket the week before law school, and I called the admissions office, and a lady named Melanie Nutt, who was from Arkansas, by the way, said, well, you know, it's too late. You can't come to law school this year. Why don't you just work and come back the next year? Well, that was disappointing because I'd had a part-time summer job with the Secretary of State's office. The previous summers, I've worked Secretary of State's office and Rose Law Firm. I would work 3 days in one location and 2 days in the other location. And while I'm working at Rose Law Firm, I got to know Hillary Clinton really well. And of course, I also got to know Bill Clinton, not as well as Hillary, but I got to know the Clintons pretty well. So there's a lot of experience in and of itself. But before law school, I just called up Hillary one day, and I said, you know, I've got my bags packed and a non-refundable plane ticket, and I can't go to law school, and the summer help programs are ending. And, you know, can you help me out, help me find something? And she said, well, you do programming, right? And I said, sure. She said, well, you mind working for the governor's office or the Department of Finance and Administration? I said, no. She said, well, just sit tight for a couple of hours and I'll call you back. And this was a Friday afternoon. Half hour later, she calls me back. She said, you got an interview at 9 o'clock in the Department of Finance and Administration. So I showed up for the interview. As it turns out, it was an interview just for formality's sake. I had the job, and the guy told me, well, what's your starting salary? And me being, I guess, 22 years old, I really didn't realize I could have named my salary. I set my salary kind of low, and later on I was told, you know, you should have gone a lot higher. We'd have paid it, you being recommended by Hillary. But I did that job. I programmed for the Department of Finance Administration for a year and got everything in order and then went to law school.
That's fascinating. Now, I can't miss the opportunity of asking you, how on earth, you just casually brushed over, oh, I got to know Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. How on earth did you get to know them well? How did it come about?
Well, actually, the first time I met the Clintons was my junior year in high school, the summer after I participated in the governor's school program, which was a program for gifted and talented students, and I was one of two blind students. One of my classmates, we were friends at the time, but in competition a lot, and we went to governor's school, and I met Bill Clinton there, and when they were campaigning a couple of times, I met him. But actually, I just called up Hillary on a whim one summer and got the job at Rose Law Firm. And during that job, I was a part-time data processor and a part-time courier. I would take packages or documents from one law firm to the other in the downtown area. I knew downtown really well, so I didn't have to drive anywhere. The other couriers got that in those positions. But some of the pleadings that I used a dictaphone, and they didn't have at the time, there was no technology for me. So I would just get in the program, put the headphones on, do the typing, and we had a proofreader. But I got to do some pleadings, some interrogatories for Hillary Clinton, and so when I took them up, I just made it a point to hang around and talk. And also, a couple of the partners took an interest in me. I used to work out every day. One of the partners was Vince Foster, and I guess you know he's the one who allegedly committed suicide. But we were really good friends, and so I learned a lot about Hillary. I got access to Hillary through him because he was also a partner.
Okay, and obviously the people listening in the States will know far more about it than me over here in England. But at the risk of getting you and me into trouble, are there any little stories you can relate to us about Bill and Hillary Clinton, for instance? Did you ever manage to play a saxophone with Bill Clinton? Because I think he's a bit of a sax player himself, isn't he?
I don't know if you knew that story or not, but I had said to Hillary that I could play the saxophone better than Bill because I'd heard him play. And word got to him. And so one day, I don't know, we were at lunch and he was visiting, and there's a tap on my shoulder, and it's, I understand you can play the sax better than I can. And so I'm not sure. So I got challenged to play the sax with him at the state capitol one day in a rotunda of all places. So we both played St. Louis blues. We'd play it together, and then he'd take a solo and I'd take a solo. And so that was kind of cool. So I did get to play the sax with him. I thought, well, there are some stories that, that's another whole interview, actually, the Bill and Hillary thing. But I did a program one time when I was programming that year before law school. Someone approached me, connected to the Clintons, and asked me to write a program to keep track of these CDs that were deposited in 11 different banks in Arkansas. Out of all of the banks, they only wanted track of certain CDs in 11 banks, and there were seven different types of CDs and or different projects that were associated with the CDs. So I had these two-letter codes that were represented each project, and one of the codes was WW, which stood for Whitewater. And I was programming in Microsoft Quick Basic at the time, so I was instructed to make the program a standalone so this person could put it on a diskette and experiment with entering the data at home. So I did that. I have no idea what data went into the program, but I kept all of my programs. And of course, I had no idea. And then, you know, 5 or 6 years later, when the Whitewater came out, it dawned on me, my gosh, I believe, I can't really be 100% sure, but I believe I wrote a program in which maybe Whitewater transactions were tracked, but I can't be sure of that. I did get a call from someone on the Hillary Clinton's team telling me that it was possible, because I programmed for the state of Arkansas, that I might get a call from, you know, Starr and his associates. And I was briefed and had conversations, you know, in terms of what would my testimony be. And it was basically, I, you know, was approached to write programs for the state of Arkansas, and that's what I did. So I never got called, thank goodness.
Okay. we've got to move it on a little bit, Doug. Love to stay and talk more about that, but we've just got to press on a little bit. What did you do after the job in Little Rock came to an end? And I take it did come to an end. And what did you do after the job actually finished?
Well, ultimately, I packed up, and my uncle and stepdad, we rented a U-Haul and a trailer and got on 40, and I went to Wake Forest School of Law. So that's where I got my law degree. The first year there, I was services for the blind in Arkansas, they were slow in getting my materials to me. I didn't have my Braille printer for a whole semester, so I got a slow start. And I was telling you this, I almost quit law school because, you know, there's a lot of research you have to do, and I couldn't use a computer system, Lexis or Westlaw. I couldn't use a computerized legal research for my first semester. Actually, I wasn't supposed to use it the whole first year, but they made an exception in my case. That was part of the reasonable accommodation. So when I did a brief or a paper, I'd have to get undergrad students to read. I'd go and research all these cases in the library and get them copied. And, you know, when a sighted person does this, they just read the cases, the important parts they highlight, and then when they sit down, they spread the documents out and they pull the thing together. Well, I've got to get someone to read these things onto a cassette, and I'm telling them, when you turn the page, please remember to tell me what page it's on, because it's important, because I'm going to need to cite, you know, where I get the information from, and sometimes they would forget. So then I would sit down and listen to the tapes, take Braille notes manually, then I would go back and spread those Braille notes out, which, you know, you can't look at things from a big picture point of view in Braille as you can in print. And so it was a lot of work. So one night I had finished, gone through all the cases, and I made my Braille notes, and I was sitting in the computer having a gripe session about how unfair it was. I had to work so hard just to get in position to study. So I decided I was going to quit. I'm done with law school. So I took all of these papers, you know, 2.5 inches thick, I walked over to the window. I was standing in the faculty apartments. I raised the window, and it was a little substandard condition. There were no screens on the windows, and it was like 12:30 on a Friday night. I pitched the papers into the parking lot. It's pouring down rain, and then I got on the phone. I called my mom in Arkansas, and they're an hour behind, so it was just 11:30 there, but it was Friday anyway. So, and I told her I was quitting law school. You know, I needed a little money so I could come home. Well, 5 minutes into the conversation, I realized that wasn't what I was going to do. So I hung up. I said, well, let me go get these papers. I go outside in the rain, and I'm tapping with my cane trying to find them, and the ones that I did manage to recover were soaked through, and the Braille was no good anyway. So guess what? I had to sit down, go back through the tapes, and get all those notes together again.
Oh, boy, what a story. Well, it shows you you were really determined to do it. You know, you really wanted to be a lawyer. Why did you want to be a lawyer?
I'm actually going to try and give you a short answer here. I had been a witness to and subject to a few injustices in my lifetime, especially being raised where I was in the McGee is a little town in the Delta region. It's like 42 miles from the Louisiana border and 35 miles from the Mississippi border. Just flat, marshy farmland, and people were really poor. And besides, I had been subject to an injustice myself. I graduated salutatorian from high school, but I should have been valedictorian, and that's, I've gotten over that, but just little things like that, and I decided I could change the world. I realized once I got into law school, you make a difference just a little bit at a time, but I had these grand ideas about changing the world and making a whole lot of money.
Yeah, now I must ask you this, Doug, because when we had our little chat the other day, you told me this wonderful story, and I'd love you to tell the people in the room this particular anecdote. Tell me about your early days at law school and a certain gentleman you came across there.
Oh, first day of law school, I don't know if you've ever read Paper Chase or saw the movie, but first year law student, they call us 1Ls or 2L or 3L. And the adage is the first year they scare you to death, the second year they work you to death, and the third year they bore you to death. And after the first day of school, I remember thinking, I can't wait to be bored, but I had this class called Civil Procedure. And a lot of the law cases aren't won on the merits. They're won on procedure, whether you filed this on time or didn't get this in on time. And this class taught you all of the procedural aspects of law. We had this professor named George Walker, whose nickname was Mad Dog, and he made it his business to really intimidate people. And, of course, before the class started, there was a note on the board that Sunday to read chapters 1 through 3 and this case and that case. So there was an assignment, of course, before law school even started. So we get in class. We introduce ourselves, and we give a brief blurb on what our interests are, and I told him, my name, and one of the things I like to do was I was a runner. So then he says, Mr. Armstrong, stand up, and he's an older guy in his 60s, and tell us about Caprom versus Van Norman. So I start reciting the facts, and the plaintiff filed the demurrer. Mr. Armstrong, what's a demurrer? I really don't know. What do you mean you don't know? You ever heard of a dictionary? Yes, sir. Well, you ever used one? Yes, sir. Well, you could have fooled me. So I'm dumbfounded, and I'm in a class with a small group, 40 people just looking at me. So, well, tell us about the case. So I told him about the facts, and then he asked me to analyze the case. And so I start analyzing the case, and, well, what do you mean? Why do you think they did it this way? So, I'm pausing because I'm trying to think of what to say. Mr. Armstrong, you say you're a runner. Yes, sir. Do you run that slow? Well, no. So somehow I got through the case. And he says, now what are you going to do? I said, well, I'm done with the case. I'll sit down. Did I tell you to sit down? No, sir. I guess I'll stand up. What are you going to do? Everything somebody tells you to do, you're not going to sit down because I didn't tell you to? Don't you have a mind of your own? So, I finally got frustrated, and I said, look, sir, I obviously came to law school because I don't know anything about the law, and you're supposed to teach me. So I'm going to have a seat so you can start doing that. And I sat down, and, of course, everybody's feeling sorry for me. So after class, there's this, like, boy, he put you through the ringer. And he did that a few more times, but being the first was, that was a... just terrorizing experience.
Well, Doug, I think I think you've got another talent. You are a born actor. That was absolutely fantastic. You told me that the other day, and it made me laugh, and it made me laugh again. That's a wonderful story, and I was really there with you. You really brought that to life for us. And well, you must have been a determined young man to be a lawyer after that. I think lots of people would have run out at top speed, but you didn't. Can you tell me a little bit about the process of becoming a lawyer? How on earth do you do it? Is it all academic study? Are you sitting there with your nose in a textbook from morning till night, or is there any practical side to it? How does it work?
Well, the quick answer, you got to have an undergrad degree, and then you get a law degree, doctor of jurisprudence, and then you pass the bar, and then you're an attorney. Now, obviously, it's not that easy. Law school consists of a lot of your classes that are theoretical, such as, you know, your contract law and constitutional law, where you read cases and you analyze them and you sort of learn to think like a lawyer. There's this technique in law school called IRAC, with a C, not an IRAC, where you state the issue, the rule, the analysis, and the conclusion. So that's sort of how you learn to approach things. Very distinct way of thinking. There were also other classes of a more practical nature where you actually sort of got involved in the things that lawyers do on a day-to-day basis. Office practice. My second year in law school, I took a clinic. And clinic consisted of a weekly lecture, and then you were assigned a supervising attorney. So I got to spend time with an attorney in practice and actually get some cases of my own to handle under the supervision of that attorney or that firm. I was assigned, I was under the supervision of a Mike Grace, who I consider North Carolina's version of Johnny Cochran. He's every bit as good as Johnny Cochran. He just hadn't had the case to, you know, with that kind of notoriety. But he was a criminal defense attorney, and some of the attorneys with him. The very first day there, he gives me these cases, and he says, you got to go down to the jail and talk to this person and, you know, kind of get the facts and then put together your defense. It's going to be a bench trial, so it's your case. So I turn around, and I'm, okay, well, let's go. He goes, I didn't say I was going down there. So I'm thinking, gosh, I got to go down to this jail by myself. No big deal. So I go down to the jailhouse, and the guard's kind of chuckling because they're familiar with how Mike does this. So, you know, they tell me, you're going to go down to the hall and you're going to go to the whatever cell. So they push this buzzer and the door opens, and this iron door clangs behind me, and it's this long hall of cinder blocks. So, of course, when the door clanged, I mean, there's this echo. And as I start walking down the hall, my footsteps are echoing, and all of a sudden I could hear, you know, some of the guys in the cells talking and cursing, and all of a sudden I think, I'm getting out of here. So I turned around and I run back to the door, and the darn thing was locked. So I had to go through with it. So I go down and get permission to get to the cell, and I finally find the person I'm supposed to find, and his first words were, Lord have mercy, they're supposed to send me a lawyer and they send me a blind man with a cane. You can't help me. So, you know, we had to spend a few minutes getting him straightened out, and I actually was able to help him. I actually won his case for him, got it dismissed, and so in his eyes, I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Again, another fantastic story. Oh, boy, I can just picture it. I can just picture you on this long corridor with all these doors. And now, you say that. How did your other students react to a blind student? Because I take it from what I understand that you were the only blind student on the course. How did the other students react to you? In fact, did they help you?
They did. There was one other blind student who a year ahead of me, so I was able to get some assistance from her. But I didn't have any classes with her. Well, I did take one class. After your first year, then you just take classes with the two L's and the three L's. So, but my classmates were very helpful. like most people, there were some who were realistic. They understood that I was just a human being, and some of them, after a while, I got some of my classmates to read for me on a cassette so I could have the lessons, the assignments done, and I was included in some of the study groups. And like most people, there were some students who were just amazed at the fact that I could walk through a door without bumping into it, and the fact that I was in law school, to them, I was just God's gift. So, and then there were those who, you know, when it came to hanging out sometimes, because law is stressful, law school is stressful, so every now and then, you know, you get a few people who want to go hang out, happy hour, and didn't think because I was blind that I ought to be drinking, or didn't think that I would be interested in dating. So you know, just because they're going to getting a law degree doesn't mean they're all that smart sometimes. But my classmates were, I would say, typical, not different from any other person in society. Then, you know, people from all walks of life and all different attitudes.
And as you progressed and jumped through these various hoops and examinations and tests and study periods that you were subjected to, when the final time came and you took your final examinations to become a lawyer, what happened after that?
Well, I have to say, I didn't tell you that in law school, most you get one exam. That was what's so hard about first year is you can go to the classes and read the assignments and give the analysis, and everything hinges on one exam at the end of the semester. And some of the exams were open book exams, which really put me at a disadvantage because students had access to these outlines that they could buy and these treatises and even the textbook, which I had first year on cassette. So basically I had the notes that I went in with or any outlines that I made. So my grades were, I was not in the top third in my class. I was maybe in the top half of my class, but that's okay. I was just glad to get a degree. Then I had to study for the bar, and that was tough because there's voluminous amounts of material, and I had two people reading just large amounts of material on cassettes, and you pay for the Barbary course, and I was able to get some outlines on computer and braille those out from other students. I did not pass the bar the first time around. That was probably one of the most difficult points in my life. There has never been a blind person pass the North Carolina bar the first time around, at least up until the point in time that I took it. I think maybe one other person had passed it the second go-round. I did pass it the second time around, but that was, I didn't pass the bar exam, I didn't have a job, I was, you know, living a couple of months with this friend, a couple of months with that friend, working for the Forsyth County Democratic headquarters. It turned out they didn't have any money. Probably in a four-month span, I made $500. So I was really just kind of out there until I passed the exam. You take the exam in August, and then I took it again in February. And I learned in March that I passed it. Well, I had the letter in my pocket all day long, and one of the ladies who worked at the law school decided she had a condo with an extra room, so I lived with her for about 8 months. And she finally that evening pulled the letter out of my pocket, and she said, "Doug, I'm going to read this letter." And the first three words were, or first few words, "I am happy, you know, to inform you," and I knew I'd passed. I didn't even hear the rest of the letter. So, but that's the process. And then I found a job a month later, or less than a month later, with the Legal Aid Society in Winston-Salem.
Just before we come on to that, you did tell me that during this this period you also helped a friend with a computer magazine. Is that correct?
There, I had a friend who was an editor for a magazine called the Computer Law Monitor, and during that period she offered me a job, and I did that for a couple of years after that, where we would summarize the latest cases in copyright, infringement or trade secret misappropriation, patents. So we'd research the cases and summarize them, try to get them down to two pages, and so I did that for about $10 an hour. And even after I started my job with Legal Aid, I did that. And I worked there for 5 years, and during that time I ended up meeting my current wife, Jackie Robinson, and we married in 97, and she got promoted. She was working for Sara Lee Knit Products as a marketing manager, and she was promoted to director in Cincinnati, and I ended up here. I worked for Legal Aid here for a year, and they went under through a reorganization, and so I just started a solo practice in 2000, and I've been doing it ever since.
Tell us a little bit about your personal life now, Doug, if you wouldn't mind. You've got a great story about proposing to your wife, and I'm sure everybody would love to hear that. You didn't actually tell me in great detail, but it's going to be fascinating and very enterprising. Tell us about first how you met your wife, and then about how you proposed to her.
Well, you know, me being an attorney, I tend to be long-winded, so I know the time may be short. But briefly, I met my wife through a mutual friend of ours. She worked with Jackie and went to the same church I went to. So we always say we met on a blind date. And she told me she knew this person I'd hit it off with, and she wanted to give me the phone number. So I returned from Christmas vacation, and the number's on my answering machine, but I had the flu, so I didn't want to call her and say we have a mutual friend but I'm sick, so I didn't call right away. And 2 weeks later she asked me again, had I called Jackie, and I told her, well, no, I lost the number, but why don't you just get us together at dinner? She says, well, I can do that, but you're such a wuss, you know, you don't want to be a wimp about it. Well, I knew what she was doing. I knew she was going for the testosterone, but I couldn't help it anyway, so I'm like, just give me the damn number and I'll call her. So she gave me the number, and I called, and we talked every day for about a week. And me trying not to be so forward, I said, well, why don't we, in the next week or so, why don't we go out to dinner? And this was like on a Thursday. She says, what are you doing Saturday? And I said, well, nothing. Well, let's go out then. So we went out, and I picked her what turns out to be her favorite restaurant. And when I proposed to her, she told me she wanted a story, and she's hard to surprise. So we went home. She figured out I was going to give her ring between her birthday and Christmas, which is in December. So I changed it up. We went to Arkansas for the first time for Thanksgiving in 96. And I got this note to the pilot, and the note said, if you could at some point give us the altitude and location and then just verbatim, you know, read the rest. So, and I had taken her out to dinner the night before and sent her roses and balloons, so she thought she was going to get her ring the night before, and she didn't. So the ride to the airport was kind of icy, and she was a little bit ticked at me when we got on the plane. And I asked the stewardess to escort me to the restroom, and that's how I slipped the note to her. So we're cruising, and she's being cold, and all of a sudden the pilot comes on, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, we have a very important announcement involving two of our passengers. And I elbow Jackie, and I go, you hear that? And she goes, I'm reading. And he goes, well, we're halfway between Atlanta and Augusta, Georgia, 30,000 feet. And at this time, a very hopeful and nervous Doug Armstrong would like to ask the very beautiful and gracious Jackie Robinson to accept his hand in marriage. And if so, he has a little token of his appreciation for you, Jackie. At which time I pulled the ring out of my pocket and put it on her finger. And everybody clapped, and the pilot says, I would just suggest that you say yes, otherwise we're not going to land this plane. Of course, he was joking, and we got champagne, and somebody gave us $40 to go to dinner, and she was definitely surprised.
No, I bet she was. Wow, that's a brilliant story, absolutely super. And I know you're very, very happy, and I believe that there's also an addition to the family.
We have a daughter who's 1 year old named Jennifer Ashley Armstrong. We agreed, her name's Jackie Robinson. We agreed that she would keep her last name, but the children would have my name. So that was the agreement. She was born on Christmas Day a year ago. And she's just delightful. She's not quite walking yet, but she's pulling up on things, and she can get around really fast, and she can get into thing. So I'm going to have to get some bells for her shoes pretty soon. But that's really a happy part of my life.
No, I'm sure it is, Doug. And that's great, especially born on Christmas Day. What a day. What a day to have a baby. Best Christmas present I should imagine you've ever had, or Jackie. Great. Can I just now revert back to your professional life? And you said that you work for the Legal Aid Society. Just give us a brief outline of the type of cases you handle.
I was put in what is called the HEC unit, Housing, Employment, and Consumer. So we represented tenants who were being evicted either wrongfully or they were living in substandard conditions. And sometimes they were evicted rightfully because they hadn't paid rent, but we were able to at least help them buy time. We made some landlords mad at us. Employment law, I represented people who were filed for unemployment and were denied, and also wrongful terminations, ADA cases. I became the employment guru of the office in Winston-Salem because that was the area I was most interested in. And then consumer represented debtors who were being harassed by creditors or people who had bad dealings with used car dealers. I hope no one on here is a used car dealer because I don't have high regard for most used car dealers, but I know there's some good ones. I did a little bit of domestic law just because we had every attorney had to rotate getting restraining orders once a week, but I don't care for domestic law. So right now I do a lot of employment law and general civil, some estate planning. So I do wills and estate planning for people. Still do consumer cases. If someone asked me to do a landlord-tenant case, I'd be able to do that. I just, in my solo practice, hadn't really gotten into that area.
From speaking to you, Doug, it seems that you are a very caring man and that you're always on the side of the underdog, as we say over here, I'm sure. I don't know if you know that expression, but I mean, you know, the little guy. Would that be a pretty fair assessment of your working life? Is your aim to help people who are less fortunate in society?
It is, very much so. Probably because of the environment I grew up in. Because a lot of the people I helped at Legal Aid, those are people like the ones I grew up with. So I certainly understood what they were going through. Not that they're always right. And sometimes I'm helping people who I know are wrong and abusing the system. But once you take the case and you realize that you've got to represent them, and that's a problem. But no, I'm for the underdog. That's definitely the case.
And you did say a little while back that you moved to Cincinnati from where you were living. When you moved, was it difficult to find employment?
Yes, it was. Cincinnati is more of a, what I think, a narrow-minded environment than the South was here. So after the job, after I left Legal Aid, I actually started doing my solo practice while I was looking. And I had an attorney in town tell me that there were, with me being African-American and visually impaired, that there were maybe between 4 and 8 partners in firms in Cincinnati, and there were more than 20 major law firms in Cincinnati. And he said, I suggest that you look for a government job because you're probably not going to be hired by a firm. And I thought, boy, that's really sad. But while I was looking, I started my solo practice, and I just got so busy after a while, I just stopped looking and just focused on that.
So you were doing your solo work, Doug. Are you handling the same sort of cases now for Legal Aid and people's housing concerns and things like that?
Yeah, there are some attorneys at Legal Aid who refer me some cases. This one guy, expungements, he refers me a lot of the expungements because a lot of his people can't find housing or jobs because they may have a criminal record, so I help them out there. But I still do mostly employment law and consumer. And as I said, I would do a housing case if I got one. And I do a lot of contracts and wills and estate planning.
Okay, and I'm just going to ask you now about your pastimes and hobbies, if you've actually got any time for pastimes and hobbies in your busy life. What do you like doing in your spare time?
Oh, I'm a big sports fan. I love sports. So, as you can tell, I'm competing in high school. The big three, baseball, football, basketball. Baseball is probably my favorite sport. So I watch a lot of sports, both college and pro. I'm a music fan. I love jazz is my favorite, but I really listen to all kinds of music. Play the saxophone when I get a chance. I'm a political buff, so I like politics. And once Jennifer goes down, I find time to come on to For the People and even get in a round of Quattro. So I that's really a great game. And so I like hanging out with the FTP crew.
How did you learn about For the People?
It was through a friend. Actually, I was signed up for the JFW Light list about 3 years ago. And through that list, read an email about Roger Wilco, so I decided to try it. And I ended up running into a group of people that sort of bonded with. You probably know one of them is Rebel, or Bruce. And became real good friends with he and a handful of other people. And from there, we just sort of evolved, went from Roger Wilco to other chat engines, and I learned about For the People from one of that crew. I can't remember which person told me about it, but through word of mouth. And so I signed up and was on for a while, and then for about a year just didn't come on, got real busy, and then lately been coming back and just realized in a year and a year and a half just how much more, the improvements, this is some great stuff going on now.
That's uncanny, because Bruce has just come into the room just as you mentioned his name there. That's uncanny, that was. And I believe you also are quite heavily involved in voluntary work as well. Would you like to tell us about that?
Well, of course, I do my share of pro bono as an attorney, and some people can vouch for that, and probably on site. I'm on several boards. Heart is an agency called Clover Nook Center for the Blind. I'm chair of the board for that agency, and I actually was a client of Clover Nook and used their employment services. Clover Nook, we have two major functions. One is in the rehab services. We provide orientation, mobility, computer training, help place people into meaningful employment within the community. And on the other hand, we have a manufacturing and operations, a blind certificate workshop. So we can put people to work who may not be able to find work in a meaningful employment within the community, or people who need some training so they can at some point find meaningful employment. So I received employment services from Clover Nook in terms of being transported to different interviews, and they were happy to have me. And then I've come full circle to being a board member, to being chair of the board, and Clover Nook is within its 100th anniversary, so I'm really pleased. I'm the first blind chair of the board in our 100th anniversary, and there are other agencies that I volunteer for. So between that and work and spare time, the day is really filled up.
And congratulations on being chairman of that organization. It's always nice, isn't it, to put back a little of what you've taken out in the past. We're coming towards the end of the interview now, Doug, and is there anything you'd like to say about your philosophy on blindness or philosophy on life, really? Big question, but any words?
Well, just in case other people have questions, I know time's running out, so I won't say a whole lot. I just know that I've accomplished a great deal in my lifetime, in short lifetime, because I'm just 37 years old, but I know that it hasn't been because of or the lack of help from other people who care about me, so I just owe a lot. I know that what I've done wasn't done totally by myself, that it's taken help from a lot of other people who cared about me, and so I try to remember that and remember where I came from. And I'm also, although I'm not a Bible carrier, I am religious, and I believe that, you know, my faith in God has a lot to do with my accomplishments and my achievements and where I am. And that's pretty much it.
Okay, Doug, and just as a little bit of fun at the very end of the interview, I'm going to ask you some quick-fire questions. And I don't want you to have any thinking time at all. The first thing that comes into your head, I want your answer, okay? I'm going to be like that guy in the law school. So I want you to stand up when I tell you to. And here we go. What's your favorite food?
Barbecue ribs, pork ribs.
And what's your favorite drink, non-alcoholic?
Sweet tea with lemon.
Do you like savory foods or sweet foods?
I like spicy foods, hot spicy foods.
And this is going to be a tough one for you, I think. Your favorite sport?
Baseball.
And in the sports world, who do you most admire?
Ozzie Smith.
Okay, what's your all-time favorite holiday?
The 4th of July, without question. Love the 4th of July holiday.
Okay, if your house caught on fire now, what would you grab? Human beings. We're going to assume they get out, but of your own personal possessions, what would you grab?
I gotta grab as many of my CDs. Once I knew my daughter and wife were okay, as many of my CDs as possible. Music is so important, and that's where I can sort of get lost sometimes. So I'd try to get as much music as possible.
Okay, Doug, thanks very much indeed. It's been great talking to you. I've never spoken to you before until the other day, but I hope I speak to you many, many times in the future. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I think one or two people may like to ask you any questions. Is that okay with you? If so, we'll do it in a minute. But before I just finally close, I'd like to thank Becky for all her hard work in Spotlight as well behind the scenes. And thank you once more, Doug, for agreeing to be interviewed. And if anyone would like to ask Doug any questions, I'm sure you'd be prepared to answer. Would you, Doug?
Absolutely, and thanks, Steve, and thanks for, you're a great interviewer, and thanks for sticking with me in all of my rambling. I'm going to be a little more patient with clients now when I try to prepare them to answer questions, because they ramble, and I have to get them to stick to the issue, and here I am on the other end of it, and tended to do the same thing, but you hung in there and stuck with it. I enjoyed it, and sure, I'm going to stick around a while, so I'd be glad to answer questions or just converse.
Okay, thanks, Doug. Okay, floor is open.
Hello there, Doug. It's Chris Kant over in England speaking to you. I don't think I've met you before either, but very nice to hear your story. Absolutely fantastic. And you've gone a long way in such a little time, and I think that's really, really great. But having not a clue about the law and what have you, how much of that, when you're preparing cases, comes off the top of your head as to what you learnt in law school? Or how much do you go back and say, reference book, every time? So how much of a case could you get through without referencing?
You know, what I find is I don't use very much of what I learned at all in law school, and maybe family law. But law school, really, the purpose of going to law school, I've concluded, is to learn how to learn the law. You learn how to think, you learn how to research, how to look up things. You really learn it either when you get placed with someone or when you get a job and you start, you find an area you're interested in, and you learn it. But very seldom do I pull something off the top of my head that I learned in law school. There are general principles, for example, in contracts law. There, every now and then I can pull a principle of law. But for the most part, you really don't learn how to practice law in law school.
I have to say it's been a real pleasure getting to know Doug a little bit. We've gotten to know each other a lot better playing Quattro, and he's a formidable player, trivia, Quattro, whatever. And I want to thank him in advance, because as busy as he is, Doug will be holding a legal clinic for us on the site here once a month, and also teaching the Eudora class, so this guy really knows how to give.
Hi, my name is Rudy, and my nickname is Hugger right now. I'm from Toronto, Ontario. Just enjoy listening to you, sir. And how could I address you? Your Honor? And if you think that I'm laughing, I'm not laughing at you. I'm just laughing at my... How can I say? My not-so-good knowledge of how to treat a lawyer. So all I'm going to say is thank you for your interview. It was beautiful.
I imagine a few people on site who can tell you how to treat a lawyer. No, really, I'm flattery will get you everywhere and then some, but you just call me Doug or Flash, really. So I appreciate the compliment and hopefully was clear and not too all over the place, but I enjoyed it. And, you know, if I can ever help you or anyone on the site, I'll be glad to do that. But the people who know me, you know, I'm just a down-home boy from Arkansas, and, you know, I don't really care to be treated, you know, special or with royalty or anything. But thanks for the flattery.
First of all, I want to apologize for being late. I thought it was at 1:30 Central. He even commented about that last night during our conversation. So I had some things to do, and I ran back just as fast as I could get back, and then I heard it was near the end of it. So sorry it was late. And I'll get this as soon as it gets archived. I'll listen to it. I just want to let you know that. And people, I've known Doug for a while now. He's good. He just, like he just said, he's just about as plain as anybody you've ever met. He is Doug. That's all he is.
And when I said there are a few people who can tell you how to treat a lawyer, you know, Bruce, you're the first name that came to mind. You don't have to do that now, though.
Well, that may have been my attitude, and I'll ask you about some lawyers or whatever until I met you, Doug. And this is just not me playing whatever, but you do find out lawyers are people, too. You're probably the first lawyer I ever got to know. And, by George, y'all are people, too.
Yeah, Doug, can I ask you another question? How much crossover law applies UK and the States? Are there some areas that really do?
I really don't know, because even within this country, the law is so different just from state to state. You know, the law in Arkansas is way different from the law in Louisiana. There's certain things. I mean, for the most part, you can count on 0.08 or whatever being the limit for intoxication, and landlord-tenant law, that's so different from state to state. Even workers' comp, for example, I learned workers' comp law in North Carolina, and in Ohio, it was totally different. So unemployment, for example, in some states, if you get disqualified in North Carolina, you get disqualified, you know, let's say for misconduct, you don't get any unemployment. And then in some states, you get disqualified, you get a minimum, say, 8 weeks or so many weeks. So I think the old common law principles we have were taken from the UK. A lot of our law is founded on old English law, especially landlord-tenant law, or certain basic principles of contract law are founded on old English law.
Before the recording stops, I want to make sure I get credits in back. Becky asked me to close for her and to tell you, Doug and Steve, how much she enjoyed the interview. We want to thank both of you for a fantastic one, for everyone who attended, and for Dennis, who records and edits these files so professionally. So thank you, everyone.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
So am I. You know, you worry about these things when you're being interviewed, but hopefully you really did enjoy it. I enjoyed doing it. And I said I was nervous when I started, but I'm always, you know, it's just one of those things. The few times in life that I wasn't nervous about anything, I did miserably. There were two wrestling matches I wasn't nervous at all, and I lost them. And so I figure a little nervousness just means that I'm emotionally ready for what I'm about to do.
I think you could have talked for another hour and kept us spellbound. I imagine it was difficult, Steve, deciding what to elaborate on and what not to.
Absolutely, yeah. I think we could have done, you know, 2 hours. It's really good, Doug. I really enjoyed that. I really did enjoy that. So great to speak to you, and look forward to the next time.